Guten Tag nochmal. Und ich werde gleich schon um Entschuldigung bitten, denn die Kabelung zwischen Deutsch und meinem Gehirn ist Kupfer mit guter Percha. Und wenn ich Englisch benutze, ist das neue Fiber. Also ich werde auf Englisch umschalten. I'm going to do this talk in English because I can talk faster. And so we'll go forward. Now, even though I'm talking in English, Chris taught me that the most important question I need to answer first is, kann man damit Geld verdienen? Okay. And so last week I saw this notice from Gartner about DevOps, a new Gartner study, that told us that by next year, 25% of the Global 2000 are going to be using DevOps as a mainstream practice. So I just want to dispel right now the notion that this is my opinion or Microsoft's opinion or some obscure idea that DevOps is something you should think about. It looks like there will be a lot of hiring going on. So you should pay some attention. Now, when we talk about DevOps, you've, of course, seen this circle all the time. We talk about it all the time. I just want to be really clear what we mean. It's a term that was first used in 2009. It was first used by Patrick Dubois, who's at Qatar Consortium now, and started the DevOps days. And it has a bigger meaning than is often used today. So we've been doing Agile for a while, and Agile's got us developing faster. And one of the things that happened when we started developing faster with Agile is we started building up work in process that wasn't getting released. So we discovered the need for an automated release pipeline. And you've probably heard about release management, and you've probably heard about other products that help you with automating your release pipeline and deploying into production. And of course, when you deploy into production, you need to monitor what is going on in production, both so that you can see performance, health, et cetera, and so that you can see the usage that people are actually making of the software being deployed. And from that usage, you can make decisions about what you do next in your backlog. So this was a discussion where Munil was talking about the notion of having a hypothesis that we turn into an experiment, and based on the data we collect, we can pivot or persevere. So when we talk about DevOps, we're talking about this whole life cycle. And there is some confusion out there because some people have taken the term to mean much narrower things, just the release pipeline or just the monitoring or something like that. But really, I think this is the consensus definition that has emerged. This is how Gene Kim uses it in the Phoenix Project. This is how Dubois uses it. This is how Gartner, Forrester, et cetera, are all using it. I don't want to debate the term. This is what I'm talking about. Okay. Now, there are seven dimensions of practice that we've needed to get good at, we find, and that we think about are as important in terms of growing your strengths or our strengths in DevOps that I'm going to talk about. And you've heard about those over the last 2 days. So this is a little bit of a summary of a practice view of how to think about DevOps. Three of these are more or less from Agile, and four, I would say, are sort of the second decade of Agile. And the way I think about it is a little bit, Kent Beck once described extreme programming. He said, when he was asked, well, what's extreme about it? He said, well, we took everything that was good about in programming, and we just said, you do more of it, and that makes it extreme. So we take everything that is good about Agile, and we're even more Agile. And so you can sort of think of this as, you know, the second decade of Agile, or Agile, you know, squared, or Agile on steroids. So it starts with scheduling and teaming. And as you've heard and seen, we think about, you know, folks work in teams and they work in team rooms. This isn't a corner of a 50-person or 100-person open space. This is a team room for a feature crew or scrum team, where if you want to have a stand-up, you stand up. If you want to have a conversation about what you're working on, you swivel your chair. If you want to have a, you know, side conversation, there's a little focus room off to the side where you can go. This, by the way, is on the Redmond campus in Building 18, which is where I work. I work around the corner from that room. And in the actually the same team room as O'Neill. And the vice presidents work in team rooms and so forth. So it's, you know, we took an old building, we gutted it, we thought this is how people ought to work. You saw some talk from Martin this morning about taking the sprint ceremonies and just reducing them to be as simple as possible. So you can take links to the product backlog items that you're working on and have a quick status as the opening of the sprint. And you can have a brief video, 3 to 5 minutes, customer facing. Here's what we accomplished in the sprint. And those emails act as the sprint ceremonies and records. Okay. And it works great, by the way, with global distribution as a way of communicating around and as a way of communicating across an organization at scale. Now, technical debt. We've known about for a long time, longer than Agile, actually, and teams have, you know, found one or another way to ignore it. But in DevOps, you have to pretty consciously manage it. Munil alluded to the story of our Visual Studio 2013 launch, which was November 2013, which was the point where Visual Studio Online users grew over 1 million and our month-on-month growth rate started to grow double digits. It's continued, and the whole thing's, you know, more than doubled since then. And we had this pretty nasty experience from not having properly load tested and had feature flags up before the morning of the launch. So we did a good pantomime, but we had a significant outage. This led to a nasty month, which you can see in this excerpt from our monthly service review. So if you look at November here, this is November 2013, which we're talking about, you'll see 43 live site incidents. And if you look, and you know, you can see we're tracking time to detect, time to mitigate, and down here really should say errors by root cause and outage time by root cause. And it was pretty painful. But you see then improvements in December and January. Now, that was the time when we had to say, hang on, we've been in one data center, and we've been talking all this time about knowing we needed to go to multiple scale units across multiple data centers, but we've been pushing feature work in front of it. And we have this, you know, stack rank of the next feature work that's planned. But in fact, what this shows is that we need to reprioritize the backlog and go multi-data center now so that we can have a canary instance to change our deployment pattern so we deploy first to a canary instance, a scale unit where we work, and then roll the deployment forward so that we can detect any live side issues before customers do. And in fact, we did. And the result of that was a continual improvement in quality of service. And if you, you know, were to look at this now, you'd see that we're indeed progressively greener using like-for-like metrics. But that notion of taking the debt, which we knew about, and saying, okay, now we're taking this big thing, going multi-data center, and trading it off in the same backlog against feature work is something we had to do then and do consciously, driven by events. All right, flow of value. So again, third practice from Agile. Agile, we talked about focusing on flow of value to customers. And we, you know, we debated, what does this mean? How do you do it? And all this kind of stuff. Well, now we can measure it because we've got all this telemetry. And we've, I think, talked about this enough. You can go online, see the features timeline page and see what's coming in subsequent sprints. So we're very open with the notion of flow, and we've talked about how we actually look at usage and will pivot or persevere based on usage and based on conversations about what's really going on and reach out. The hypothesis-based backlog. This is perhaps the biggest change in mindset. Now, this is a shift from Agile. Agile assumed an omniscient product owner. It said the product owner grooms the backlog. The product owner deals with stakeholders. The product owner figures this out. The product owner does, you know, all these things. And it didn't really give the product owner a lot of help in terms of how to do that. And it didn't really say what happens if the product owner is wrong. Well, instead of that being the way we do things, we still have a product owner who grooms the backlog and ranks it. But the backlog is not a set of pseudo-requirements. I mean, there's still user stories and so forth, but they're just hypotheses. They're beliefs. We believe this, and we believe it in a way that we can prove or disprove. We can turn that into something that we can test, and we can, based on the test, support or refute. So, for example, if you want to see what we believe right now about where we ought to go with Kanban, there's a blog post from our colleague Aaron Bjork, who, you know, shows where we think we're going, and this will come up on Visual Studio Online progressively. And he describes in there set of hypotheses and why about what he will be doing. And as these come on progressively, we will be collecting feedback. And as Martin showed this morning, it may or may not be exactly like he has mocked up, but we'll watch and we'll try. And we'll use progressively feature flags. And the idea of the feature flags is that all the development is done behind feature flags initially, and all code is deployed from master. But the flags allow runtime control so that the flags can be raised first for the individual feature crew working on this or for one person working on this. And then our closest users can get exposure and comment on it and say, I like this, I don't like this, what have you. If you want to be in that inner circle, you just raise your hand and we include you. And we can launch things in the dark, that is, supporting services can be done that aren't seen. And we have this progressive mechanism for experimentation. If we say, it didn't work so well, people don't like it, they're confused, whatever, we do something else and keep going until we lift the flags for everyone. Okay, so the experimentation mechanism using flags is built in, and it's just become the way to work. So we have a notion that the backlogs hypotheses, and because we have feature flags as a way of controlling exposure, we can turn those hypotheses into experiments, and that leads us to the next point, which is we can collect evidence and data to support or diminish those hypotheses. So here's an interesting example, not from Visual Studio Online, but from Visual Studio, the IDE. One of the key things we're always interested in is how engaged our users are with what. Now, what do we mean by engaged? We try to measure engagement in lots of ways. One of the ways of measuring engagement that we're doing is daily active users over monthly active users. In other words, out of the people who have come and, in this case, used the IDE in the last month, how many use it on a daily basis? And you do the division, daily active divided by monthly active. What's the ratio? And here we contrast that by type of VS project used. The top line happens to be an Azure Cloud project, and then there are different sorts of language projects going down. So, the most engaged users by far were folks working on Azure, interestingly. And you see a huge variance, more than 2-to-1 variance by different types of projects, which was a really interesting finding that we applied to an very on-prem product, the IDE. Okay, this isn't from Visual Studio Online. This is extending the same principles to something we ship. Now, that only works if you have a production-first mindset, which we've talked about quite a bit. So production-first means you keep the site up, you keep the product up, you treat any live site issue as an emergency, as the most important thing you're doing, and you trade in that backlog, as we discussed, quality of service and feature work against each other, and we'll put the quality of service there. So going way back, since we started, we've had monitors on the wall to keep everyone aware of site status. This is in all our buildings. You just know this is a much, much earlier version of the dashboards that you see in the Twitter feed. You can see there with our hashtag. So if someone's coming on saying, I need help, you get it there. And the live site issues are recorded in our VSO instance, formerly our TFS instance. And you can see, you know, the details down here of where the outage was. This was a little over an hour, and a lot of the timing, which is filled in here. If you weren't in Munil's talk earlier on the details, everything here is driven to root cause. That's the RCA tab, which isn't brought forward. So we know what really caused this, not just what triggered it, but what really caused it, and then what we do to prevent the recurrence under problem management, and we track the communication as well as the incident. And we use multiple channels. We use the service blog, we use Twitter, we use email to everyone, and all of those channels together. And as I discussed, we went to multiple data centers. We talked about this. And the reason we went to multiple data centers was to be able to canary. So the canarying, if you're not familiar with the term, and I don't know if they say this in German, canary in the coal mine. So I don't know if Yeah, okay. So canarying's become the term from that. So the we had, prior to November 2013, one data center in Chicago. That's where most of our customers were connected. We added one in the deployment sequence before that, in San Antonio. That's where we connect and work. And that becomes the deployment canary. So the deployment automation goes there first, and we watch that, and there, and using our VS release management, there's a gate before we roll the deployment to keep going across the remaining five data centers. We're now in six, including Amsterdam, which is number four in the sequence, and we will keep adding them. Okay. Right. So that's production first. Now, of course, we're using public cloud. And that gives us flexible infrastructure. We scale up, scale out when we need to. We can take advantage of that flexible capacity. Development happens in the cloud when, you know, users connect, resources are warmed up, and so forth, and that's all part of the mechanism. And of course, we're doing this in Azure. It's up in, I think, 19 regions open for business now, and is at hyperscale. Now, I don't want to give the impression that DevOps is only for the public cloud. TFS is much bigger in its usage on-prem than Visual Studio Online in the cloud. And DevOps, as a set of practices, is very applicable to what you are doing in the data center, as well as in the cloud. Although many of the practices sort of grew up in the cloud. So I think of this in terms of an analogy, and I'll draw on Martin's talk this morning. So Martin talked a lot about the history of the transatlantic telegraph. I think the most famous telegraph operator, although that's not what he's known for, is probably Thomas Edison. And he made actually his money initially on improvements to the telegraph. His first big set of patents were around a bidirectional telegraph that let New York and London communicate with each other at the same times instead of asynchronously. Now, Edison also in the 1880s, and of course Edison is known in popular culture for the light bulb, which is what that drawing is of. Edison in the 1880s built up, I think, 170-some power plants that were all DC, direct current. Now, there's a problem with direct current that most of you, I think, know, that it's great for certain uses, but it is limited in its geographic range because you push direct current down a wire and the wire turns into a resistor. So, in 1890, in Frankfurt, there was a demonstration of his rival's invention, and then a few years later in Chicago. You probably know who these guys are. Someone knows who these guys are. Anyone? Tesla, exactly. Tesla, who worked for Edison and then quit, and Westinghouse, who then bankrolled him. And Tesla invented AC, alternating current, Wechselstrom, for power transmission. And of course, you can use a transformer and step up the voltage and transmit long distance. And Westinghouse invested in this and demonstrated this long distance. Now, here's the question. Edison had already invested in these power plants, and they had a big war, and Edison tried to prove that AC current was not safe, and it was a big, stupid PR campaign. But Con Edison is still the name of the New York Public Utility. Who knows when Con Edison turned off its last profitable DC power plant? Any guesses? How long was it in operation? Uwe, I'll pick on you.
40 years.
Any other guesses? 120. Okay. So it was only shut off in 2007. And of course, the great irony is we now have solar panels and electric cars, and DC's coming back. So when you think about the cloud and you think about the data center, and people ask me, are you going to still do TFS? Now that you're doing Visual Studio Online, the data center is going to be around for a while. I think the practices that we're learning from the public cloud world are going to be used in the private world, and data centers will coexist with the public cloud for a long time. So, all of that is DevOps. And we do have a saying in DevOps that there's no place like production. For those of you who remember Kansas in the movies. And DevOps is not only for the public cloud. Thank you very much for staying. I'm happy to take questions. I'll hang around as long as you'd like. Munils, you're welcome to join me. Anyone? And I know I'm standing between you and your, you know, last beer and everything else. Okay. Go ahead.
Maybe just one question. You are saying DevOps is not only for the cloud, so when will you provide already a lot of metrics for your cloud services? So when will we get something for the on-premise TFS?
Well, you do. So every time we ship a quarterly update for TFS or a new version of TFS, it is based on the code that has been running in Visual Studio Online.
Well, I mean the kind of measurements you're doing for the cloud service. I mean, most of them are also interesting if you have an on-premise TFS, right?
Well, so what we're doing is we are monitoring the instance we're running in the cloud and the usage that's going on in the cloud. And the things that we are delivering to the cloud, we then roll up and deliver to the as the next version of TFS or the next update to TFS.
I think the question was kind of if application insight will be on premise, right?
Ah. Okay.
Okay. Using, for example, the application insight. I mean, this can be in the cloud, but I want to monitor my on-premise server, right? On-premise TFS.
So if you want to monitor your on-premise TFS, you should use the System Center Management Pack. And we're updating the management pack for TFS 2015.
Another question?
To be honest, I'm afraid a little bit of interruptions. How do you handle interruptions of work? Is it a problem in the teams that people stay focused on special work? Because when you have principles like everybody got to lay out everything when there's interruption, it can be a problem. It's often people are happy that they're not interrupted, that they're able to stay focused on a special task.
Jez Humble has a great saying: "If it hurts, do it more often." We have the attitude, you build it, you run it, and if it's the developer who is the designated responsible engineer who's woken up or interrupted, the service and code gets better. So the goal is not to have to have that interruption, but we get better and we swarm the problem and we turn it into a learning experience. The result is that, you know, the positive side is you get to see what people are actually doing and how they're using it. Munil, why don't you
take I was just going to add a couple of things. So I don't know if you were there in my previous talk, but we had this problem where there was a lot of resistance from the team in the beginning that they didn't want to be in the front line, the engineers in the front line, meaning they didn't want to be the designated responsible engineer because of the concerns that they may get called at odd hours of the day, weekends, etc. And the concerns were legitimate when we had very high alert volume with a lot of noise that I mentioned. Like, you know, you get 10 alerts, and out of 10, 8 are bogus. You know, there was no need to wake somebody up in the middle of the night. Once we got down to a very good precision that an alert fires is a real emergency, and you need to deal with that right away. In fact, we just recently switched to a model where we can then auto-dial the engineers and call them. Then they understand it. They understand their responsibility, and they want to, in fact, handle it because then they can understand the real problem versus an operation team who might just patch the problem with some short-term fix. So they really want to address the root cause, and it's not been a problem. Not interrupt the whole team. Yes.
If you get the noise out of the system, in other words. So there, it took work to get the noise out of the alerting, and it took an investment in a health model that would get the noise out so that you would get a, if you got alerted, you could be confident it was real. And now you're, you know, if you get alerted, it's real and you get the information. And in fact, it's better. It's much better than the old model where you have tiers of escalation and it's hard to get to the real information.
Another one? Final question? Let's say the final question. No question. Matt?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming.